This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You're here with Love Our Proud
with Z and G on Joy 94.9. And we have on the line, all the way from Los Angeles, big star, big comedian and writer on Seinfeld.
Very special guest.
Very special guest, Fred Stoller. Thank you so much for joining us, Fred.
Oh, thank you. Excuse me, I don't know about the big star part, but...
I think in the comedy fan community, you definitely are a star.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, there's a lot of young people that don't know me, these snarky podcasts or these...
Right.
Yeah, it's like the young kid that were nerds in schools are now bullies. They are snarky and make faces and some weirdo. But I won't. It's like funny. Like people will recognize me, say, or they'll say to me, they go, "Are you famous?"
Yeah.
I say, you have to ask.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Where do I know you from? That line.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I have to explain. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So, do you find yourself? Like, I mean, because, you know, you're obviously a star within the comedy community itself. I mean, are you finding the respect, you're getting respect, like, I mean, these, like, in later in life?
Well, you mean from the comedy community or in general?
Yeah, from the comedy community.
The comedy community, it's weird because the worst thing about writing a book is trying to go on podcasts and push it. You guys were great. You reached out to me. But they have these kind of – these different factions of comedy.
Yeah.
They have the Joe Rogan, Jay Moore, testosterone, I am a man, pussy, if
different
you're liberal.
Cliques. Yeah, there's different cliques of comedy.
I don't fit in. And they have this – I couldn't get on Joey Diaz because it's all about, hey, I did mushrooms, hey. I did an hour, you know what I'm saying? I like what's his name – I can't think of his name. Ari Shaffir.
The think tank.
But still, there's that kind of
skeptic tank.
And there's this other faction of comedy, like Jim Norton, Colin Quinn, you're a pussy. I'm just like a pussy to them because, you know, they're like, they're aggressive. I don't fit into that.
Where would you say, Mark Maron? What about Mark Maron and stuff like that? You could fit in with them.
He's great. He's great. He has me on to plug my stuff. Again, I know I'm accentuating on the negative of the people that won't respond to me. But this comedy, bang, bang, they don't know who I am. It's that kind of – it's a different sensibility.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, there's so many things. You know, there's so many different kinds of
There's so many different
TV
outlets.
Shows and comedy.
That's right, yeah. So many different platforms for comedy now that it's crazy.
Yeah, there's all it's so specific.
Yeah.
So, but I've gotten respect. I'm happiest when I don't try to push myself into the comedy world. You know what I mean?
Okay. I like being from an outsider's perspective.
Yeah, but that's a long-winded answer.
That was a great answer.
I shouldn't complain. I'll give you an example. I met Bill Burr, and I thought he'd be one of those, aggressive Nick DiPaolo guys.
Oh, right.
He's one of the nicest guys. He's a big fan. And I really enjoyed meeting him.
Where did you meet him?
I always get this guy's name wrong. Al Madrigal.
Al Madrigal. Yeah. You got it.
He has a podcasting network, and I briefly tried doing a podcast, but I didn't have a good focus, and I hate bugging people to be on it, but they had some Nerd Melt show,
and
Bill Burr was there, and he was just a big fan, so...
I feel like you'd be great having a podcast, Fred. You'd have so many friends in the comedy community to be able to come on, that you'd be having so many great guests, Fred.
Like I said, I tried, but if someone would do the heavy lifting, like try to bug people...
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can I interrupt you, ask you a question about Australia?
Of course.
Go for it, Fred.
There's a guy, I should tell him to listen to this. On Facebook,
yeah.
For the most part, I used to accept everybody because I don't want to say no to anyone and I don't want to be obnoxious. Say, hey, join my fan page.
Of course, yeah.
But there's one guy, a really great guy, pop culture fan from Australia, who seems to be so much more into American television and American pop culture than Americans are. And what is it? And we don't, I guess, unfortunately, have the same thing for Australia. Like, I don't think people, comedy nerds, listen to Australian podcasts.
No, that's right.
So I appreciate that, but is there something to that?
No, it's more, I think, the fact that, I guess, Australia, we either grew up on American comedy or we either grew up on British comedy. So there's two sort of factions there on a foundation of comedy. But I guess we both really grew up on...
But not only stand-up comedy, this guy, I know we're not talking about him, loves, like... Showtime show. He'll just go in on about that HBO, you know, well, Netflix American show. Right. So you have a nice thing for American TV and all that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it depends upon which sort of, I guess, comedy foundation. Yeah.
But it's
but like I said, it doesn't seem to be just comedy with this one guy, at least.
No. But even in.
All right. Enough about that guy. I'm being ridiculous.
Well, we don't have a lot of – it's more as time's gone on, Australian TV's sort of picked up when we're making a lot more of our own shows and stuff.
But I see.
For it to break out of Australia is its own thing.
Yeah, again. That's right. Yeah. That doesn't really happen. But, I mean, it's only because, you know, America is – that's the Hollywood mecca. That's a television mecca. It's the movie mecca. That's why.
Right. Yeah. It's changing. I mean, it's funny how – when I see a movie now and I see a black guy in it, in the credits, I don't recognize his name. I assume he's from Great Britain, and he is.
Yeah.
There's a lot of African Americans from England,
coming
here. I love it. There's a new show, The Deuce, I'm enjoying.
The Deuce? Some good people. What's that on?
That's on HBO. David Simon, who did The Wire. It's not comedy. It's a drama.
Okay. Do you enjoy your dramas, Fred?
Yeah, actually, this goes back to my start in stand-up, but I started stand-up in 1978 in Hell's Kitchen in the Improv, and it was like Taxi Driver. All the porno theaters and a seedy area it was in, and the show on HBO called The Deuce is in that era, so it's nostalgic.
Right.
It's Taxi Driver CD stuff. So that's when I started stand up.
Was Bud Freeman the owner of the Improv at that time?
Actually, when I came to the Improv in New York, he just got divorced, and his wife, Silver Friedman, took over the New York Improv.
Right. Okay. Was there a shift in how comics got on stage?
I never would, like I said, I just came when Bud left, so I didn't know how it worked with Bud. And actually, the manager was Chris Albrecht, who ended up running HBO, The Sopranos, so much seminal stuff. And it was interesting because I don't know how comedy works in Australia, but I didn't know that the totem pole, the low end of the pecking order, MCs. But in New York City, MCs were the biggest people. They set the tone. Yeah. Larry David, believe it or not, MC'd.
Oh,
Robert Wall, who you know from Arliss, maybe.
Yeah.
Bill Maher was an MC. Richard Belzer,
At
Catch a Rising Star. Yeah. So the MCs were the higher ups. They decided who goes up.
That's crazy. Larry David as an MC, that would have been wild to. Would he have made it?
It didn't work out.
Yeah, exactly.
Well.
He wouldn't have made it through the entire lineup.
He would storm off the stage if people weren't laughing or someone was talking. And there was a fight once at Catch a Rising Star. Lenny Dykstra, who was a New York Met, yelled at him, you know, and they were kicked out. So, he didn't do so well as a stand-up.
Wow.
But was well-respected.
So you started stand-up in 78 at the Improv. At what point did you move out to L.A.?
10 years later in 1988.
88. Okay, right. So did you do full 10 years of comedy in New York at that time?
Yeah, well, I'm from Brooklyn, New York, so I used to take the train until it took 2 years. I got my own apartment. My first 2 years of stand-up, hanging out in New York City with people like Gilbert Gottfried and...
Wow.
and others, I would take the train. And then, yes, I ended up just doing New York. And New York, that was the comedy boom of the 80s.
Right.
Yes. Where I didn't really, I was able to make a living, not a great one, but just doing middling New Jersey, yeah. Long Island, Connecticut. I never was the headliner. The headliner, okay. Well, aggressive, high energy, you know. Right. People like Bobby Slayton would come in, and or just locals, guys you wouldn't have heard of, like a guy John Mulrooney,
okay,
a guy who died, Dennis Wolfberg. So I was able to get by just being low key and being a middle act.
How much would you get as a middle act in the mid '80s?
God, I can't remember. Like New Jersey, those bars and discos, 55 for the night. But other places like,
and is that a 10-minute set? 15-minute set?
No, 20 minutes.
20 minutes, okay, as a middle, but okay.
Other places, you know, like a weekend, maybe 75 a set or hard. But wow. You could do like 4 sets and then you did a lot during the week. I may have to go on Facebook. And you guys, feel free to Facebook me. I'll accept you. I know you. But I'm going to ask these Facebook people, what did we used to get? See, the problem I had was, I was a middle act.
Yeah.
And I got by in New York. Then I moved to L.A. And because I had a Letterman credit or something, okay. I'd headline. And I wasn't used to doing 45 minutes or an hour, especially right. with my low-key, subtle act.
Okay.
So it was really, yes, it was eye-opening and just crazy.
Did you? Was it a situation where during the hour you'd have to have during the middle sort of a filler? Or it was
I thought you meant an intermission.
No, no.
And play bingo or something.
Well, you'd have filler.
Well, I'd always stretch. Like, when I'd have to do four. Well, when I would do college. Okay, this is what I learned. I had to learn the hard way on the road.
Right.
When you do New York, you could just come up and do your act.
Okay.
You know. But it took me a while to realize if I'm in San Antonio or Cleveland, you can't just start. You got to show, you acknowledge you're on their turf.
Mm, okay.
Like, hey, here, hey. Or like, so I would do like a college and you have to do an hour. And not only did I not have an hour of material, my style was just low key, kind of like Stephen Wright, yeah, not conducive to it. So I'd say, could I have this school newspaper? So I'd have references. Oh, Mrs. Local, Mendelson is the new president. Ah, he mentioned us. Hey, I see you have a bowling alley across the street. Ah. So I would take notes and just, you have to cater to them, which watered down my act. It's funny when I did a part in Dumb and Dumber, my first time I did a part in a movie outside of L.A.
Right.
So I was walking around Utah, taking notes, going, okay, I'll mention, you know, that whatever, that store. And I went, wait a minute, I'm not doing a set. I was so conditioned on the road that I had to walk around and take notes.
That's funny.
To have more material and to cater to them.
Did you, while you were filming Dumb and Dumber, where did you film it? In Utah?
You know, I don't remember. I remember they flew me to some place the day before and I met the wardrobe people. And then... The next morning, we took some, you know, van and drove somewhere. I have no idea where, by that motel where I was bothering the guy to get off the phone.
Yeah. What a great thing.
So, thank you. So, I don't remember where, but I know it was in Utah.
Now, I remember reading. Were the lines in for that scene scripted out, or did you sort of ad lib that?
Yes, what happened was, that was my second part in a movie, and excuse me, and my first part was in this movie called Junior. Ivan Reitman directed it, and it was where Arnold Schwarzenegger was a pregnant man.
Oh, right, yeah, that one.
With Danny DeVito. I think they were trying to redo the chemistry from Twins, and it didn't quite work.
Right. What a crazy
premise. So basically
premise.
What happened, yes, so I was just a waiter, and I had to just say one line and put food there.
Right.
And Ivan Reitman was really like, get out of there quick, you know. Mm. I go, well, I have to put the food down, you know, and he was really intimidating, just you, you know, and I was just shivering. And so I thought, all right, that's what you do when you have a part in a movie. You got to get in, get out.
Yeah.
So basically, then I go to the Farley Brothers, Dumb and Dumber, and I go, okay, all it said in the script was knock on the phone and go, and then the guy punches me and they go, well, aren't you going to do some stuff? And it was such a breath of fresh air. So what happened was in my stand-up act, they used to do these jokes. I'm a thrill seeker. I drank milk that expired yesterday. I'm a badass. I'll eat an apple and I won't wash it. I'll buy it right there at the deli. So when I auditioned for Dumb and Dumber, I auditioned not for that part, but as a the one of the bad guys, and
I was
supposed to get it, but they wanted it to be a woman, so this woman Duff got it.
Oh.
She used to be on MTV and stuff. So during the audition, I was doing it like a pathetic bad person because I'm not going to be a real real bad person going. I don't care. I'm fearless. You know that thrill seeker persona.
Yeah.
So they did. They said do some of that. So even though that shtick used to be I live on the edge, you know, I'm crazy. You know, I bought a pen for 79 cents. I gave the cashier 80 cents. I said keep the penny. I'll say that. I walked the hell away. So basically. Yeah, so I started acting like that guy, like, ooh, you got me mad. Ooh, I almost like it. Don't you mess with me. So it was sort of like that character.
Okay, yeah. Well, while we work out whether or not we can spare that extra penny.
Who knows?
We'll be listening to this song. You're listening to Laugh Out Proud.
With C&G.
On Joy 94.9. And still on the line, we do have, in fact, big comedian, thank you so much for joining us, Fred Stoller. Thank you so much for staying on the line. But before the break, we were talking about your role in Dumb and Dumber and how that line was ad-libbed. But you're still doing stand-up now, you're talking about, just in the break.
Yes and no. To be honest, I took a break when I started getting voiceover work and acting on sitcoms, and then I was writing. Mm-hmm. I wrote some of those books maybe we'll talk about. But I say stand-up, you can't dabble. You got to hang out every night. I hate any scenes. As I talked about, there's the aggressive comedy, the Jay Moore guys, there's the nerdist, cool, snarky. And I like expressing myself in ways like this or just in a book. When it's joke, you got to love it. So I took a break, but then I had a book. And I didn't know there was a thing called the Jewish Book Festival circuit.
Really?
So they wanted me to do my act, and I traveled around various American cities where I didn't know they had such tight-knit Jewish communities.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And I thought, oh, maybe I could dabble again. So Norm Macdonald sought me out to open for him.
Right.
And for close to a year, I was opening for Norm Macdonald, and he was just texting me today wanting me to open for him some more. But it sounds fun when you hear Norm.
Yeah.
But he's as crazy as you think it would be to open for him. He can't do anything. I don't know if you have Uber down there.
Yeah,
but,
we do.
He goes, I don't know how to do it. Get me the car, you know, and I have to pay. There were jobs we did where he forgot to pack pants.
Oh, really?
And just had sweatpants. And goes, I don't have pants. You got to do something. And yelling at me. And he doesn't drive. And He forgets his wallet and he yells at me. And we were in one city. All right, maybe I could get sued, but he did some weed. Maybe it got him paranoid. Weed's legal.
Yeah.
He was screaming at me from the side of the stage, paranoid. I was ripping him off.
Oh, really?
So it's no shock. You would think this guy's crazy. He can't do anything. So I'd have to be his assistant anytime you bump into someone, hey, Freddie, give them comps.
So,
and I have to take everyone's name and then
give him a
so it started being not fun.
Does he not have his own assistant?
Not he doesn't. He's not a superstar like probably Amy Schumer could travel with an assistant.
What about
he wants to have someone that will open for him. He could hang out with and he could abuse and. and does everything.
What
for
about
him.
His What about his sidekick on the on his Norm Macdonald Live? Adam Egan.
I think he wants Adam to do it, but Adam doesn't do stand up.
Right? Yeah, he's only.
You got to kind of do an act.
Yeah, yeah.
It was fun for a while, but the money, you have to get there a day early, okay. And I wasn't getting good money at all,
right.
And so I, you know, you're this. It came to like $100 a day, but get there a day early, and
still
yeah,
fun.
It's not as exotic as you think. I'm glad. Look, one of my big regrets is that when I was doing comedy in the 90s,
right.
Sam Kennison, you know him, right?
Yeah, of course, mm-hmm. Kennison, God.
He loved me because I used to do those thrill-seeker jokes like, okay. I'm a badass.
Yeah.
And he thought it'd be funny if I toured with him, like, you know, because he had the Outlaws of Comedy.
What a great
guys
contrast.
Like him.
Yeah, that would have been.
And then I come out like a badass. I'm crazy, you know. I was on an escalator. I like with a handrail. And he wanted me to open for him, but it would be a month in Vegas.
Right.
And I was too nervous to leave my cat or just yeah, LA acting for a month. But man, the stories I could have had being an opener for Sam Kennison.
Right. That's the
craziness. But so I have those for Norm Macdonald.
So at what point? At what point were you? So you're writing your book. Were you opening for Norm at that stage, or at what point were you opening for Norm?
Well, which book did the 5 minutes to kill?
Yeah. Well, which book were you writing at that stage?
No, actually, what happened was I was we're opening for Norm.
Yeah.
And basically, to set up the book, you know, a lot of people in the States don't remember that these young comedian specials on HBO used to be big launching pads.
Yeah, yeah.
This is back before Comedy Central. It launched Saget, Kennison, Dice Clay, Roseanne Barr, Seinfeld, you know, because they didn't have that much.
That's right.
So I said to Norm, you know, I had an idea for a documentary because I always thought it was interesting that two made it big from it.
That's right, yeah.
Woman is struggling and two sadly are deceased from crazy stories. Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, you should do a but how do you, and then they'll go, yeah, well, let's do a documentary.
That's a great Norm impression, by the way. I love it, Fred.
Oh, yeah. He hates it. So then, you know, he would flake out, you know, and I go. So then when it got to be a little bit, to be honest, weird opening for Norm where he'd blame you if, you know, he lost his wallet, yell at me, you know what I mean? Or just things that I had nothing to do with, you know, if the car wasn't waiting for us at the airport, yell at me.
Jeez.
If the Uber guy didn't know how to get to a grocery store. So I said, you know, I need to do something where I'm not dependent on someone else.
Yeah, it's just so
it'd be a lot of work to try to do a documentary. What do I do? So I had success with my Seinfeld year, which was a Kindle single about writing on Seinfeld. So
fantastic.
I approached them. I said, oh, thank you. I said, how does this sound as a story? They go, oh, we love it. So I was still touring with Norm Norm doesn't like to tour a lot. He only goes once a month.
Right. Okay.
So I would tour, I would do a weekend with him, then come back and try to get interviews with, widows of people from the special, club owners, managers, different people.
Okay.
So basically, so I was finishing it up, and then there was a lot of fact-checking, legal stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Rob Schneider was cool.
Was it hard getting in contact with them, with the bigger names, Rob Schneider and stuff like that?
Oh, actually, I got to thank Norm for that because he was traveling with Adam Sandler returns to stand-up, and Show Me the Funny Tour. So it was Rob Schneider, David Spade. I'm at that age. I can't think of names. Nick Swartzen.
Swartzen,
And sometimes Norm would go on the tour. So Norm called me from speakerphone. Hey, how much Schneider and Spade? And I said, hey guys, I'm glad you're on the phone. Could I interview for this?
All right on.
So Norm actually helped, even though they know me.
Yeah.
That validated it was a real book, a real thing.
So in the sort of the what made you create, I guess, the Kindle singles? What was the initial launching point? I mean, was it the fact that you didn't necessarily have enough material for a publisher to fill out a full book?
That's exactly it. I didn't have enough material.
But see,
that's
the thing I love about the singles is that it's, you know, it's short and succinct. You know, like it's there's no fluff. It's all the facts are right there.
Yes, yes. What happened was years ago, I wrote a book, the book that it became Maybe We'll Have You Back, about being a perennial TV guest star. I can't remember what year. Maybe
2013.
A version of it was finished, and this was before PDF. So when I would try to send a manuscript to New York to a literary agent, I'd have to print up, you know, like 200 pages. It's double, you know, space, and send it FedEx. And I actually ended up doing a bit about this, but it's true. A lot of the book agents would say things like, well, we like this. We wish there was more sex. And I go, me too. Or, you know, they want it to be gritty, like Marc Maron, sex rehab. I crashed my car. I was, you know, And one of them said, we wish there was a happy ending.
Right.
You know, one of them said, we like this. We wish it was a bigger star. So they weren't getting it. So I was kind of discouraged that, it wasn't gritty. This faux grittiness I hate. Okay. Like, hey, you know, so many people are in sex rehab or drug rehab and they have books. So it sat in my computer. I said, you know, maybe one day I'll be famous enough where people want to read my memoirs, but not right now. Cut to PDFs. And I sent it to a few friends. Hey, this is really good. You should revisit this. And I said, well, I'm not really the perennial TV guest star actor anymore, and these are old shows. And a friend of mine said, well, no, it's still Seinfeld and Raymond and Friends. People know these shows. So then he got back to, okay, this guy, oh, I'm outing him, but I don't care. all right, I won't say, but he
I doubt they're listening, Fred. It's okay.
Yeah, he worked for a big producer who was kind of a prima donna, you know, just one of these, you know, big people. So he used to be a writer, reporter in New York, and now he's a TV. So they said, will you write about so-and-so? He goes, I don't think so. He goes, oh, because someone he knew was developing something called Kendall Singles. Okay. So then he introduced me to the guy saying, well, Fred, maybe you could do a Kendall single. And I said, what's a Kendall single? You know, it was just starting.
Yeah.
And I sent the editor my manuscript. He goes, this is funny, it's sad, it's good, but how could it be a single? So he said, let me think about it. So I siphoned off the chapter about writing on Seinfeld.
Right, right.
And then the editor said, put in your childhood to set it up. And so it did really, really well. That was Kindle singles at first were really big. And that was the first and only at the time behind the scenes look at Seinfeld, the writer's room.
Yeah, that's right.
So And just a lot of good luck where Marc Maron, I went to timing, something the equivalent of what you do, the public radio, but they have something, Marketplace is a big, and that was on it. So it did really well. So that led to a literary agent, and I brought back the book, and I got rejected by a lot of publishers, but eventually one took it on. And awesome. So it was kind of backwards. But actually, years later, when a publisher wanted it, I put stuff more current in it.
So on Norm, I saw you mention when you were about to talk about the first book that you wrote, Maybe We'll Have You Back. You were about to say that you were sitting on the book for about 10 years. Is that...
That's what I just said,
You're sitting on it for like 10 years. So in that time, were you constantly going back to it and adding stories, or were you just...
No. You just like had it written? Like I said, I kind of gave up. I would send it to a literary agent, and they would pass. I sent it to one or two publishers, they would pass. And I always had that dream, you know. What I loved about the book, I mean, the experience of it is I always want to have a book. I love going into bookstores, walking around, smelling books.
Yeah.
And I didn't even care what the money was. It wasn't for, oh, this could be money. I just wanted to tell my story.
Mm.
So once in a while, I thought I'd get a lead, like Phil Rosenthal, who created Everybody Loves Raymond. He had a book, and so through his lead, and then they weren't interested. So once in a while, I would try to bring it out if someone, you know, see, you know, I thought I had a lead, but I did give up. But so I was just pursuing other things in the meantime. I wrote that movie, Fred and Vinny, I did, and other things. So then when it got, when they wanted it, then I updated it.
Right.
New stuff.
Okay. So in my Seinfeld year, you were talking about, I think it was in my Seinfeld year, you were talking about people had these sob stories about their children. So you made up that you had an 8-year-old son named Mitchell.
No. That was in 5 Minutes to Kill.
5 Minutes to Kill. So you made up, and then I remember you mentioning, though, you had a cat.
Yes.
Named
yes,
Mitchell.
Good
is that,
cat.
So
you say.
Did you
Mitchell
name
Mitchell was named after my imaginary son.
Right. Okay. Wow. So that's fantastic. I love that.
So I ended up, Mitchell was my son. I had an imaginary son. Then he was the love of my life. He died a year or two ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Made it to 18. Most amazing, amazing cat.
And
tuxedo.
Would have been an amazing fake son as well, I bet.
Yes. I try to bring him back once in a while when I need a pep talk or not to feel like a mopey loser. Like you don't act like a loser for your son. But you're the first one who caught that, yes.
Oh, really? The first one? Wow. In my Seinfeld year, so when you were writing for Seinfeld, it was the 94-95 season, you said, right?
Correct.
What sort of... Because you were talking about how all the writers are, you know, are very cliquey and stuff like that. So, and you weren't really hanging out with the main writing group.
Correct.
Was it really just you every sort of day? Was it 5 days a week you come in?
Yeah, I believe so.
So was it just in your own office? Did you have your own office?
Yeah, I had my own office, but it was different than other TV shows because most TV shows have what's called a table,
right,
where they break down the stories and you write this one, you write this, and they, so then you go off and write your own story, but then the table helps punch it up.
Yeah.
They didn't have any of that on Seinfeld. You were on your own to come up with ideas. No one really wants to help you because they're trying to get their own ideas approved.
Right.
And then you go off and write it, and then Jerry and Larry rewrite it. So there was no collaboration whatsoever.
Was there
total isolation?
So how were you out on the 94? Would have been computers by then. So you were typing away on the computer.
No, well it was computers. There was not really the internet. No. They used to have. Have you guys written screenplays?
We've written scripts, but
back. Can I ask how old you are?
25.
Oh, you're too young to remember this, but. Early carnations of script writing, TV, was something called paginating,
right,
where it didn't automatically have the page number and I'd have to keep going to the writer's assistant. And so it wasn't really as we know. It was a computer, but not like these Macs or,
right, okay,
you know, or Dell. No, it was very funky.
So how long did it roughly take you to bang out a script? So how long did it take you to get?
Well, I only got really one and a fourth on. Basically, the process was that you have to get a Jerry, Kramer, Elaine, and George story approved.
Okay.
So, and you have to kind of hunt them, Jerry and Larry, down. Mm. And it was like they're never in the office. They're on the auditioning people are editing, they're filming.
Right.
So it's like, so you're on your own. And then when you get all four, then you have to show how they connect. So basically, it's just the process of however long it takes to get it all approved.
Right.
By them.
So is it literally you running up to Larry or Jerry at any point during the day when you had some sort of half-baked
idea? Yeah. Like
Just trying to pitch to them.
Yeah, I talk about that in my Seinfeld year because my first story, my friend who worked there the year before didn't get asked back, told me, which was true, getting Jerry's stories approved are the hardest because he doesn't have as many neurotic flaws.
Okay, yeah, of course.
So I got lucky because this annoying comic who became Kenny Banya in real life gave me an Armani suit. He didn't fit him, and he goes, I want a meal for it. So. Yeah. So that's a true story. I took him to this place. He got soup and soda because I'm going to save the meal for another time.
What counts as a meal? Yeah.
Yeah, so that became the story. So I got lucky my first time. Then I had to get the other stories approved. My second script, I was striking out with Jerry stories. Oh, Larry, oh, Jerry wouldn't care about money. Jerry wouldn't do that. Jerry's not neurotic like you.
Right, right.
You know, I even pitched a story for George, and Larry goes, isn't that kind of pathetic he's doing that? I wanted to go, George, it's too pathetic? What? So the process was just getting the story approved and figuring out how everything connects like a Rubik's Cube. Mm. And then when everything is storyboarded out, like I showed him on the I would bring Larry into my room if I got him in my office, right, and go, how about this? He goes, no, have Banya right away say he wants the suit back. And, you know, and then he yell at me, you know, where's your pencil? You're not writing this down. Like I was a waiter, you know.
So in that entire process, at what point, because Larry and Jerry, didn't they then take the script and rewrite it themselves?
Yeah, they shut the door. Oh, that's what you mean. The rewriting is about 2 days. The door shut, and when they decide we're doing this script, and they shut the door and rewrite it for about 2 days.
So how much of the original script that you wrote was what came out at the end?
Well, I was lucky in the fact that three out of four of my storylines remained pretty much intact.
Wow. Wow.
I knew a guy I based the Kramer story on. In real life, he had his refrigerator removed because he wanted more space. So I wrote stuff that they took out, like, you know, shticky, what's it called, physical comedy where Kramer is carrying the refrigerator down the steps and slipping and, you know.
Would have been great for Michael, yeah.
And I told him that at the table read. I thought he was mad at me. He was looking at me like, you only gave me a little part. And I went up to him like an idiot, go, I wrote so much more stuff for you, but Larry took it out. He goes, can you tell him to put it back in?
Oh, no.
I went, all right. And he screamed, well, you don't talk to the writers. Get the hell out of here, idiot. I mean, he goes, you don't talk to the actors. So a lot stayed intact. Actually, speaking of Dumb and Dumber, my Dumb and Dumber story with George got thrown out. What happened in real life is that there were two wardrobe women in Dumb and Dumber, and cute, and I was equally attracted to either one of them, and I didn't know which one to try to kind of flirt with more, because then what if the other one liked me, and she doesn't want to be the second choice.
Yes.
So that was the George dilemma. Like, he'd go to some theater or something in the ticket booth with two women, and he wasn't sure which one to accentuate, and he had to equally flirt with both of them.
Right.
And that got changed to George said the word manure or something with a woman. So that wasn't mine at all. But a fair amount of Kenny Banya's lines were as they were.
Oh, wow.
Like the guy really said them, yeah.
Did you write, was Jerry doing the stand-up in those episodes when you were writing for it?
Yeah, and I remember sitting in the room and they were trying to come up with material and I was striking out with stand-up. And I would say something, they wouldn't even acknowledge me. So that was the one or two times where we got together as a group and trying to write stand-up for him, but no one paid any attention to me.
So the stand-up itself on that episode was written separately to the script?
Yes.
Ah, okay, wow. Because I heard a lot of some of the script writers would write the stand-up.
Yes, and I wasn't too successful. Yeah. But that's right. So in syndication, I believe they took the stand-up clips out just to have more room for commercials.
Right.
So I didn't even know if you've seen the stand-up stuff and where he would comment on what was going on.
But, okay, so you're the latest Kindle single, of course, 5 Minutes to Kill, How the HBO Young Comedian Special Changed the Lives of the 1989's Funniest Comics. That book is out now.
Yes.
And available.
It's just a Kindle single,
Yeah. We have to
adopt
the new phraseology. Kindle
single. But it's actually, very reasonably priced. Actually, it's free if you have Amazon Prime or Kindle Unlimited.
Right on.
Fantastic.
And also, my Seinfeld year, the Kindle single is also available there.
Yep, Prime and Kindle Unlimited.
That's right. And Maybe We'll Have You Back is also available in all good bookstores, I'm sure, Fred.
Maybe not bookstores, but you could get it online, okay, Amazon, right. Barnes & Noble, different places.
And is there anything else that you want to plug, Fred? Anything else on the horizon for Fred Stoller?
No, just, you know, I did some fun voiceovers. I love animation. There's I never saw some show called The Regular Show on Cartoon Network, but he's doing, the guy created it, is one for TBS. I just did two episodes of.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
So, cool. So I want to write more. So I
do you know what?
I like writing these memoirs, so I'm working on something now. I did Clarence. I did Adventure Time. I did Two Bob's Burgers, but a lot of preschool stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Andy Manny, which is not too edgy.
But and also people can get you on the Facebook if they just add you or like the page.
Yeah, like the page. I'm on Twitter. Why don't you send me this link and I'll post it, and that way you could comment on it for my friend from Australia.
You'd get
a kick at it.
That sounds good. We'll send you a link, definitely. Thank you so much for joining us, Fred. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad the Skype worked out.
It did. It all worked perfectly. The magics of the internet, right?
Yeah. If you need anything else, you let me know.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Friend me on Facebook.
You've been listening to Laugh Out Proud
with Z&G
on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.